Halton here. At MSA, our health and safety drives them to develop advanced safety equipment with performance and protection in perfect balance, like Globe Athletics, the latest innovation in turnout gear. Developed as athletic gear for firefighters, Athletics uses unique stretch fabrics that provide body contoured fit for unprecedented range of motion and flexibility. It's lighter weight, less bulky, and provides the protection you need from your turnout gear. Get the full story at msafire.com/globe.
Hello, everybody. It's Joe Pernesti. I want to welcome you to another edition of In Their Own Words on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Once again, as always, I want to thank Chief Bobby Halton and the staff at Fire Engineering for giving me this opportunity of bringing you the best from the authors of articles online and in print. And today we are going to interview Mr. Robert Callahan of the Bossier Fire District in Louisiana, Bossier Parish Fire District. And in the July 2020 Fire Engineering Magazine, he wrote a very good article on what would be considered small box. It's the title is 10 Commandments for Operations in Small Box Stores with Limited Staffing. And basically we're talking about the most common buildings that are popping up all over the country, the dollar stores, the auto parts stores, even a little bit of some old school Main Street type three. So without further ado, welcome our guest, Bob Callahan. Bob, welcome to the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Well, I'm been in the fire service since 1979. Started out with a college student-run fire department in northern Vermont. At that time, there were four of them, sort of a unique situation. Then I migrated around a little bit, was on some volunteer departments, some suburban departments in Vermont and in New York. Moved down here to Louisiana in 2002. Got hooked up as a volunteer with Bossier Parish Fire District 1. Was hired in 2009 as their fire prevention and training coordinator. Currently, I'm just the fire prevention officer. They've detailed out the training coordinator part to somebody else, give me more time to do fire prevention. I'm also the training officer for two small rural departments, and I also work for LSU Fire Training. They're the state training agency in the state, and I work for them part-time, delivering programs in the northwest part of Louisiana.
So this article, 10 Commandments for Operations in Small Box Stores, why'd you write it? What led you to write this article and do your work types of buildings?
There's several reasons. My actual first article that I wrote for Fire Engineering was actually tied to the first time they accepted me to teach at FDIC, and that was on large vehicle fire operations. And the small box stores are pretty much the same thing in that they're, for most fire departments, they're a relatively rare event. Even if you look at large departments, if you look at commercial building fires, it's probably less than 5% of what they run on. And certainly for smaller departments that I'm on, we don't see them very often. We might see a working small box store fire once every 3 to 4 years, just like we don't see large vehicle fires very often. So it's very dangerous for us simply because we don't have a whole lot of experience. It's not something we do on a regular basis. We tend not to use the skills that are associated with commercial building fires, which are very different from residential fire operations. So it's a pretty hazardous little endeavor, and I just felt that it was important to cover it because we have to be informed as to what we need to be doing, not what we think we should be doing on these types of operations.
Yeah, and what, you know, what I like about it, you know, one of the things with with fire engineering and when they have authors that pen articles is that, you know, there's nothing out there that is new, and we're always trying to create ways to enlighten the newest firefighter or someone trying to refresh a company officer trying to refresh their skill set. And what I liked about your article is that you broke it down. You broke down some very common principles and tactics for these buildings. And the kind of buildings that we're talking about here, again, are the dollar stores, the auto parts stores. In the article you mentioned they're around 9,000 to 20,000 square feet. And they're national chain stores that can have, you know, all these, we say modern, but, you know, the newer or the, let's take, for instance, a Family Dollar with all those plastics or that type of store, general type of store, you know, with all those plastics, all those combustibles, today's modern fire environment, you know, these plastics are releasing their heat, you know, faster than ever before. And you have a bomb on your hands, basically. And what I love and what I want to get into for our listeners is, you know, again, you break it down into 10 commandments. And that's what's so great about this article is that you can take this article and create a class based on your community and the types of small box stores in your community and apply the 10 commandments to your individual store. So that is what's really drew me to it and I loved about it. So let's get right into it. You know, you mentioned the very first commandment, know the building. The building is the enemy. And so what kind of construction are we talking here with these small box stores?
Well, you could be looking at anything from a type 3, which has been around for 100 years. An example of that is downtown Minden, which we run mutual aid into. They have Main Street USA, where they have type 3, two-story type 3s that have probably been renovated 15 to 20 times. Really don't know what you're going to find. And you have to understand what Bob, you're going to be looking at and building construction and be looking at in a type 3. You could be looking at a fully sprinkled type 1. You could be looking at an unsprinkled lightweight construction type 2, maybe a heavy truss type 2. So it's going to vary a whole lot just depending on where you are. And rule number one is officers and firefighters have to know not only about be able to regurgitate the facts and figures about the building construction, but what's actually going to happen to that building when it catches on fire. That's really at the end of the day, the important thing. When there's a fire, what is that building going to do? And if we don't understand that, we're setting ourselves up for a big potential problem, maybe only 5 minutes into the incident.
Yeah, that's what I'm finding in what is, you know, really whether it's Louisiana where you're at or in Ohio where I'm at, Northern Ohio, I'm finding that, and you're in the fire prevention business, that these companies are, you know, the construction of these, their architects and the companies building these, they're making them to where they fit under the laws or the ordinances or whatever that would require sprinklers. So that's what I find a lot in these standalone, especially in the standalone type 2 constructed buildings, is that they're building them in my area to where they just make it to where they don't need a sprinkler. Are you finding that with newer construction down where you're at in Louisiana, the same thing?
No, definitely, definitely. In fact, our requirements for sprinklers are, compared to most states, are pretty liberal. So you can easily build a 30,000 square foot building that doesn't require sprinklers in most places in Louisiana.
Yeah,
we rarely see sprinklers in these buildings.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we're talking a lot of stock, and that brings us into your second commandment of, you know thy fire behavior, to understand fire behavior. And with these buildings, it doesn't matter where you're at in the country. These buildings, these are chain. Would it be fair to say we're talking chain type stores that are going up here? Correct. You know, they're going to be the same
chain
type
stores.
Yeah.
Chain stores or regional stores. We have several furniture stores that would fall into this size requirement that are fairly regional. But again, it could be the downtown general store in town X, Louisiana, that has everything from hardware to clothing to tools to chemicals to fertilizers. It carries everything the town needs. It's the only store in town, and everything's in there.
You're right. And the thing with again, if it's a connected Main Street building or a brand new type 2 auto parts store, the one thing that I found that when we talk about fire behavior that our younger members listening to this have to understand is that when they make these, they don't have a lot of windows. There's no windows on the B side. If this is a standalone building, at least where I'm at, the B side and the D side, even the C side, or the 2, 3, 4 side, depending on what you want to call it, there's no windows. The only windows are the front showroom type of windows. And when we talk about fire behavior, we have to understand that we have very limited ventilation in these, and that, you know, if you've been at the wrong time, you're going to pull all that fire. If you're sending crews in, you're going to pull all that fire back on them by venting those front windows. That's a pretty fair statement.
Oh yeah. And Charleston illustrates that. When I'm teaching this class, that's a prime example is what I use. Cause you can see how radically things change inside that structure, what they take out those front windows. Yeah. And unfortunately there's a lot of officers in the fire service that are still haven't gotten that message that ventilation is not our friend anymore. That ventilation is now our enemy.
And you think you're doing the right thing by venting now, you know, and you think, well, we're going to let the smoke out of this. And as soon as you take those big plate glass windows, you know, especially if you have any kind of fire up into the, and we'll get into it a little bit more with the construction of these, but if you have a drop ceiling space and you have fire above that drop ceiling, once you take those front windows, any kind of fire net is starved for oxygen, it's going to light off. And you can really get your crews in a pinch with these. And so that's why I liked, again, you know, you know thy fire behavior, and that's what it's all about. The other one, your next one is, know thy mental hard drive. Curious what you mean by that for those that haven't read the article, your third commandment, know thy mental hard drive. What do you mean by that in that type?
Well, that gets back to the fact that we make decisions using a process called recognition prime decision making. And essentially what that is that as we go to fires, as we go to incidents, we build up a mental hard drive of what we respond to. And if we go to an incident where we don't have a whole lot of previous experiences, we don't have that mental hard drive of what we did at that last small box store fire and what we did at that last box store fire that was successful. So our mind is searching, searching, searching. And if we can't find a mental hard drive to match that fire, it's going to go to the last residential fire we went to. And if we start using our mental hard drive, residential mental hard drive on a commercial building fire, things are going to turn out really badly. So for those departments that don't go to a lot of fires, they don't have that mental hard drive. They don't have that background, and they get very lost when they see that infrequent event without a mental hard drive.
That very, very, I very well put. Great point. I had just finished interviewing the chief of San Antonio Fire Department. They had a line of duty death in a strip mall, and when I interviewed the chief, one of the lessons that they learned in this unfortunate event was that he mentioned that, you know, it was residential type of thoughts and tactics at a commercial building. And that you hit home with that point there, that you can't bring the residential mindset to these. And if that's all you go on, and for the most part, you know, in Louisiana, I'm sure it's the same in Louisiana as is Ohio or all across the country, that we go to bedroom fires. We go to a residential house fire. We go to a kitchen fire. You know, we're not going, you know, we're stretching, you know, an inch three quarter line, knocking the fire down. Okay, maybe we've laid a second line, but you know what? The fire is under control in 15, 20 minutes. And
yeah, when we view 2,000 gallons of water, maybe 3,000 right. If it's a bigger house, and things are good. That's not the way things work when you got a 25,000 square foot small box store on fire. You're going to need a lot more manpower, a lot more hose, a lot more water, a lot more command functions. You're going to need a lot more than a single incident commander. You're going to need to use your incident command system. So it's a radically different operation. And unfortunately, if you don't have the metal hard drive for that type of operation, you fall back to residential operations. And that's where we get into trouble.
The number four, thou shalt not overrate thy capabilities and thou shalt pre-plan. Again, I love how you set this article up, but explain to our listeners that fourth commandment of the small box store.
Well, first thing is pre-plans. I'm going to be honest. There aren't too many firefighters that wake up in the morning, whether they be volunteer or career, and get really excited that they're going to go out and do pre-plans that day.
Yeah.
Whether it's new pre-plans or updating pre-plans. They do them most of the time because they have to. They walk into the building, they say, has anything been changed in the last year? The owner says no. They get the signature. They bring it back to the fire prevention person. They haven't done a walk around. They haven't done a walk through. Okay, perfect training opportunity. This is like, and I'm here in Louisiana where we have a lot of Dallas Cowboy fans. Maybe that's why the Dallas Cowboys are 1-3 this year. Maybe they're not looking at the pre-plans before they play the game on Sunday. But we had the answers to all our questions about what's going to happen if that building catches on fire in the pre-plans. We know the building construction. We know what's in the building. We know how it's laid out. We know how much water it's going to take to put it out. We have the ability to pre-plan whether the doors are fortified. Okay, we have the answers to the questions, but a lot of times we don't work very hard to get the answers, and we don't use those answers when we have a fire. So we're wasting an opportunity when we don't use those pre-plans.
Well, exactly. And I'd love to have your opinion on this, is that we're talking pre-plans, you know, in 2020, every firefighter, you know, I'm not a big believer in you got to have something written on every single building in your jurisdiction. I don't work in a huge city, but I work in a city of about 56,000 people. And what I found, though, is that if you go into one of these buildings, they're going to be pretty much a cookie cutter of another similar type of building in your jurisdiction. For instance, and I love your value or input on this, we got two auto stores in my jurisdiction that basically almost touch each other, to where they're on separate roads, but they doggone near back up to each other, but they're different store names, franchises, but they're relatively the same. If a young firefighter walks into one and they have something now that everybody has, a camera, a phone, take a couple pictures, you're going to get the same layout if he goes and walks 1,000 yards to the other store and walks into that one, you know, I mean, that to me is, this, you know, I mean, so when we're talking pre-planning, would you agree that, you know, do we need to have with these small box stores an elaborate type of layout, or would you encourage a younger member listening to this that, you know, pretty much are going to be the same. You have to understand the construction. And once you understand that, the newer ones, they're all going to be the same.
To some degree.
Yeah.
But the trick here is the officer that's supervising that crew, or the senior man, whichever it is, actually takes the time to explain to these newer firefighters why that concealed space is important, or why those exposed lightweight trusses are a problem, or why the stock is a problem. If we're just walking in, asking the questions, walking out, getting back in the truck, then talking about where we're going to go for lunch, we wasted a training opportunity that we need to be taking advantage of.
Absolutely. That is so well put. That and to get out there and getting into these buildings, very, very well put. You talked a little bit about command, and that brings us into the fifth commandment of small box stores. Thou shall know the incident command structure. What are your thoughts? Explain to our listeners your thoughts on command and control in these buildings.
Well, again, we need to exercise our command system. Honestly, 99% of our calls in the fire service are going to be calls where we have an incident commander, and that's about it. The incident commander is going to be the safety officer. He's going to be the liaison officer. He might talk to the deputy. He's going to be the PIO. He's going to be everything, because it's an EMS call. It's a single vehicle car wreck with one patient, two patients. It's a dumpster fire. It's a vehicle fire. We're not using the incident command system. So we have a problem when we get to those 1% of the calls, okay, deciding when we're going to initiate an operations person, when we're going to initiate a water supply officer, when we're going to initiate an inside division commander or sector commanders or whoever it is. So if we don't train on expanding the system, whether it be classroom training, whether it be chalkboard training, whether it be tabletop training, whether it be field training, when we get to these incidents that we need to get into using multiple positions in the incident command structure, again, we don't have the mental hard drive to do it, and we struggle when we have to expand out that system. So essentially, we have to recognize that in a small box store fire, the incident commander is going to need an operations chief. He's going to need a water supply officer. He may need a dedicated RIT officer. He may need a dedicated rehab officer. He may need a staging officer. And if we don't exercise that, he's probably not going to put those positions in place, and he's going to become very overwhelmed very, very quickly.
Yeah, and again, yeah, and when we talk about these buildings, you mentioned one thing, and we'll kind of kill two birds with one stone here, because you do mention it later on with your commandments, but I would love to touch on this now. RIT. when you look at these buildings, and if you are going to go interior, you know, for the most part, if you get an advanced fire in one of these things, and it's 0300 hours, you know, for the most part, we're going to probably go with a defensive mindset. But if you are going offensive, you know, a three-person RIT team really doesn't do you any good, you know, in one of these stores if something goes south. What are your thoughts and your advice to those listening specific to rapid intervention and in these types of buildings?
No, we struggle with RIT. And one of the main reasons we struggle with RIT is our mutual aid departments are far away. Our fire district is 172 square miles. Wow. And I have some fire districts next to me that are 300 plus square miles. So our help isn't around the corner like it was in Vermont, where I had four volunteer departments within 15 miles of me. So we struggle with RIT in a lot simply because we don't have the help right off. But you three people aren't going to do it. Phoenix did a lot of hands-on practical work after the Brett Tarver incident. And they came up, they determined that they needed 16 to 18 firefighters to rescue one person in a commercial building. And of those 16 to 18 firefighters, 25% were going to call their own Maydays. St. Louis did a lot of hands-on stuff too, and they came up with some pretty similar numbers. So we got 16 to 18 firefighters to rescue one firefighter. 25% of them are going to call Mayday. So now you start doing the math on what you need for RIT, and you get into some pretty astronomical numbers when you start looking at trying to rescue a firefighter down in a commercial building. It becomes a problem very, very quickly.
Yeah, and that is something that if you are going to, yeah, well put. And for our listeners that may not know, he references Brett Tarver, firefighter Brett Tarver of Phoenix, that passed away in a fire, I believe, is back in 2003 in a supermarket. And yeah, after his passing, Phoenix Fire did a bunch of research and studies, and they found that you know we're fooling ourselves if we think three or four people can get a firefighter out of a jam in a commercial building. And if those that are listening aren't aware, there's lots of good information. You can Google Brett Tarver and Phoenix Fire and get all kinds of information. Moving along.
And that goes back to the residential mindset, you know, two guys, three guys, they can go into a 20,000 square foot house, find the guy probably inside of 2 to 3 minutes, pull him 15 feet to the door, as compared to now you got to find somebody in 25,000 square feet and maybe pull him 125 feet to the door. Whole different ball game.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As we move along, you talk about water, and your sixth one is thou shall know thy water supply. And we mentioned this about the amount of materials, whether it's a type 3 Main Street or a type 2, brand new type of building or hardware store, that, you know, we're talking a commercial building where you're going to need water, regardless of your mode of operation, offensive or defensive. But explain to our listeners a little bit more about your thoughts on the water supply and fighting these fires.
Again, you need to know your water supply. Around here in my area, most of my residential properties are tanker operations. I do have hydrants down the main drag through our district, which is where most of my commercial buildings are. But they're spaced out. They're not every 500 feet. They're every couple of thousand feet. So I need to understand, or if you're in a situation, you need to understand that maybe two engines on the initial alarm isn't going to cut it if you got to go 2,500 feet to your hydrant. You need to understand that I may need to add two additional engines just dedicated to putting 2,000 feet of LDH on the ground. Also, I have to understand my hydrant flows. Again, 700 gallons a minute, for me, is fairly normal. That's what I'm going to get out of my hydrants. So I need to understand that if I need more water, it's either go 5,000 feet down the road, which is really not particularly practical, or bring in a tanker shuttle operation early enough to be able to support that 700 gallons a minute I'm getting from a hydrant. So just understanding your water supply and understanding that your water supply is not going to be the same at 4 o'clock in the afternoon when everybody's coming home Yeah. Taking showers and cooking as compared to 4 a.m. when everybody's in bed and nobody's using the water. So you need to understand your water system, when its peaks and valleys are.
We're talking about water. Let's move right into fire streams. These stores, you know, we're talking large streams. If you're going to, even if you're knocking down fire, explain to our listeners your thoughts on the seventh commandment of a small box. Thou shalt understand the need for high fire flows and transitional fire attack.
Yeah, I'm unapologetically heavy flow. I believe in 2.5-inch lines at commercial building fires. I don't care how much fire there is, how little fire there is. I believe that you want to put at least 250 gallons a minute on the fire. Now I'm also unapologetically smoothbore, which down here in Louisiana is a message that it's tough to get across because just about everybody here is combination nozzles, 100 PSI tips, and nobody wants to handle 100 PSI tip. So everybody underpumps them. That are pumping at about 145, they pump them at about 110, 120. So that 1¾-inch line, you're lucky if they're pushing 120 gallons a minute out the end. I'm a smoothbore guy. I believe in putting a smoothbore nozzle on the end of a 2.5, have that in your bed for commercial building fires, right, and be able to flow that 275 gallons a minute. Have a monitor. If you don't have manpower for a 2.5, put a single inlet monitor on your truck. Again, connect it with a 3-inch line. Put an 1⅛-inch tip on it. You're going to flow 300, 325. I'm a believer in putting water on these fires. No matter how you do it, you got to put water. That 1¾-inch, again, is for those bedroom fires, that residential fire. It doesn't belong in a commercial building fire.
Absolutely. And again, we're talking that... In these stores, regardless of what they are, you know, there's a couple things that big stream will do. Number one, if you have a drop ceiling, if you open up that line from the exterior, so let's say by the front door, and just start flowing up into the ceiling area, you're going to penetrate through that drop ceiling. If it is type 2 with open web metal bar joists, you're going to cool that area down and keep those trusses from expanding and pushing away. But the other thing that I have found that you need to do is take a young firefighter. So if you're listening to this, or take an engine company and instead of sitting in a recliner, go out on a Saturday or Sunday. It'll take you minutes to do this. Go when the building is closed, set up like you're going to stretch a line at the front door, but go on the B or D side, or just so you can see, and not flow into the store, but flow against if it's standalone, open and show the penetration that you would get into this store if you were to really flow in it. So if this building stands alone and you got parking to the left or parking to the right, stretch a line like you would think like you were going to go in and flow and show your members how much penetration and how far into the store you can get from the front door with the 2.5. You know, that's something that we sometimes lose that teaching to firefighters that the 2.5, you don't need to get right up on that fire. The smooth bore like you favor and you flow it, you're going to penetrate and go damn near all the way through that store to be able to hit the back wall, or if you don't want to stretch, take the measurement of a store and go in a parking lot and flow and say, this is the depth of this store. How far are we getting with this 2.5? And you'll be shocked the firefighters will be shocked at how deep they really could get with this toenail if they had to.
And part of that is also a culture.
Yes.
Because I know there are departments out there and there's firefighters, especially old school firefighters, that believe that if you're not close enough to the fire to feel the heat and feel like you're a baked potato, you're just not doing your job. They don't like to hit it from a distance. Yet we have streams now that we can hit fires from 50, 60 feet away, and we have some of these old school guys saying, you got to get closer, you got to get closer, you got to get closer.
Right.
Why? Why? Why can't we knock it down from 40 feet? Make it safer, make it easier for us, but we got to deal with that culture that exists in some places. It says, if you're not close enough to feel really hot, you're not a real firefighter. And it does exist. That culture does exist in places.
Oh yeah, absolutely. It certainly still does. As we move along, you know, your other one I really want to hit on too is I want to talk a little bit about your thoughts about positioning apparatus. You know, again, this is you talk about what we do every single day, and that's the residential fire. Let's talk a little bit about your thoughts to our listeners on positioning of fire apparatus at these stores.
Well, that gets back to, as we've talked about, it sounds like a broken record, but it gets back to that mental hard drive, because we're used to putting the fire truck on the A side of the house, stretching the line through the front door, and that's 90% of the time. That's where we put the truck. We don't get to the rear. We don't have a side option. So just almost unthinkingly, when the driver pulls up at a commercial fire, he parks it at the A side. He parks it at the front door, especially if there's nothing visible. Now, if the officer goes in and finds a fire, that may not be the best spot. Okay, the fire might be in the back. The fire might be in the storage area, in the storage room. And now your truck is in a position where you have to drag 120, 130, 140 feet of line to get to the back, as compared to if the truck is staged in a position where he can go to the front or go to the rear after the investigation is complete. Maybe now he can set that truck up by the back, by the freight door. And now they only have to pull 100 feet of hose to hit the fire instead of dragging a 200-foot pre-connect through the store to get to the fire. So again, it's a change in mentality. And one way to do this is when you go to an EMS call at a commercial building, is actually have your driver stage where you want them to stage and then bring the equipment from there into the store for the EMS run. I understand it may involve carrying the equipment an extra 20, 30 feet, but at least you're building up some type of a mental hard drive where if there is a fire, the driver's used to that staging point rather than going immediately to the front door.
Well, you're right. And we go back to when we were discussing pre-planning, is that I have found that a lot of these, you know, dollar type stores or whatever you want to call them, dollar stores or auto parts stores, while we mentioned they don't have any windows on the side or in the rear, what they do have is, while they may not be a normal large overhead type of door, you'll see small little overhead doors that they utilize to bring stock in. And a lot of times those roll up doors will give you good access. If you see that, that's usually a stock area that you can get good access in if you need to. But spotting apparatus, the thing that like your opinion on is that sometimes we rush to place our apparatus, that especially our truck apparatus or our aerial apparatus, that sometimes, you know, if you're going to set up your apparatus for defensive operations, you know, you want to get it right, and you also don't want to get it in any kind of collapse zone or anything, that, you know, take your time and spot it correctly, for your big streams, especially at these buildings that are going to be prone to collapse quickly. So you want to, you know, you don't want to put your engine right in front of the front showroom windows. When they blow out, they're impinging on your apparatus. Also don't want to get your truck right there. That, you know, think about it for our listeners. One of the things that I want you to consider, and Bob's opinion on it, is that picture a strip mall or a small standalone store. You get a fire during business hours where there's cars in the parking lot. If your engine, your chauffeur, your driver, whatever you want to call them, pulls up by that front door, now that pumper is right there in the, it's really basically looking down the barrel of the shotgun. And everything's coming right out of that. And so we have to do we have to think about where we're spotting our apparatus. As we close
and
things
one
up
other, here, one other consideration real quick with that is sure. You may want to spot your have specific spots, especially if you're going to have a store where you know you're going to have a problem getting to the rear with that 200-foot pre-connect. Or hopefully you're somewhat progressive and maybe you have a 300-foot dead load on your truck that you can pull for these buildings. But you want to put your apparatus in a place where you know that you can get the hose into certain parts of that structure. And positioning without that knowledge could leave your crew short when they're trying to make that stretch.
One thing you mentioned about the hose lines, I want to back up a little bit. That is a very good tactic for our listeners. Again, if you haven't done this, maybe, or you haven't done it since the academy, but Bob had mentioned the use of smooth bores. And one thing that is excellent with the smooth bore, if you lay in that 2.5 with the smooth bore and you knock down the fire, you take another 100 feet or 50 feet of 1¾. Let's say you've knocked that fire. You can take some hose, take the tips off of that 2.5, that smooth bore. If you take the 1⅛ or 1¼ tip off, once you take those tips off of that smooth bore, that's 1½ male. You take your 100 feet or 50 feet of 1¾ coupling, screw that on, and you got a new nozzle. You got a shut off right there, and you can go and mop up. So
you got your overhaul line.
That 2.5 allows you, you know, you're stretching less hose lines. You've knocked down the fire, and it's a smart play. So just something else to think about with these lines. Lastly, I want to touch on your thoughts and what you wrote in the article about truck company operations, Bob. Explain to our listeners your thoughts on truck work in these buildings.
Critical. Now, around here in the rural areas, we generally don't have trucks, which was a big change for me when I came down here. Obviously, in New York and Vermont, where I was from, Massachusetts, most mid-sized volunteer departments and larger have dedicated truck companies. Down here, you don't generally see truck companies in most suburban combination departments. But truck work has to happen, whether you have a truck or not. Search has to happen. Forcible entry has to happen. Ventilation has to happen. So you don't have to have a truck to do that. You can assign an engine. You just have to make sure you have enough engines coming in that you can assign an engine a truck work. Now, around here, all of our engines carry K-12s. They carry chainsaws. They carry gliders. They carry most of what we're going to need to do truck work. So for us, assigning an engine to do truck work is not a big deal. But in these buildings, you have to do truck work. Whether you have a truck or not coming in, truck work has to happen.
Absolutely. And again, when these buildings, you know, we talk about, you know, truck work, you know, it might be pulling some of these ceilings in the type threes or, you know, pulling some the drop ceilings down in these commercial buildings. But one other thing with truck work, or we're talking about fire, little bit of more of a finding the fire tactics that I want to hit on and in your opinion on is that when you go into and this is a monumental safety, number one safety thing, it has to happen. Now, when you go into one of these non-combustible type 2 buildings and you maybe have a minor smoke condition or reported fire in the rear, and you go in the front door, one of the best things that you can do as a firefighter is when you get off the truck, they have a hook. And when you go in the front door, as soon as you go in the front door, move some of that drop ceiling by the front door. And the reason for that is if you find that as you go farther into the building, and let's say you are in, if you're listening to this, picture a auto parts store that you frequent or a bit in with a drop ceiling. Once you get farther in, and let's say there's a fire in the stock room area or where they have stock, when you go through the front door and you start heading into the stock room area and the fire conditions start to deteriorate or they get up there over your head, you could have a collapse behind you and trap your members, trap yourself. So you have to figure out if you got a fire above your head. So for our listeners, for our younger members listening, one of the biggest things you can do, best things you can do, whether or not you have anything showing, is get off the truck with a hook that you know you can move some ceiling, because you move that, that could save your life. That right there.
In fact, in the class I teach at FDIC, I talk about two situations. A situation in the mid-1980s in Chesapeake, Virginia, where we lost two members to a fire in the overhead space that flashed and came down on them. And then there was a similar fire in Ontario, I'm not sure, somewhere in Ontario, Canada, in the 1990s. Same situation. No heat, no smoke, fire in the overhead space. Eventually it got to the point where it flashed over, came down on top of them and killed two members on a hose line. So if we don't know what's going on above our heads, we're potentially setting ourselves up for a whole lot of problems.
Yeah, exactly. Bob, in closing, what else would you like to add for our listeners about these buildings? Anything that we haven't touched on that you would like to share?
I would just like to communicate to the officers, especially chief officers, training officers, that these buildings have to be trained on. I understand maybe it's been 3 years since you went to a fire, and maybe that fire 3 years ago was a pile of smoldering boxes. Maybe you've never had a fire in these buildings. Right. They have to be trained on. Your members have to be familiar with what to do when they occur, whether it be through walkthroughs, whether it be through tabletop training, whether it be through discussions on training nights. However you do it, there has to be some way that you communicate what you're going to do and, more importantly, what you're not going to do when you have an incident at these buildings. Because if your members... Again, especially if they've never dealt with a fire in these buildings, they have no mental hard drive, they get an incident, and if they don't have that training, if they haven't been told this is what you're going to do and definitely don't do this, things are probably not going to end up well. So we have to take them very seriously. They represent a pretty significant safety hazard to your members.
Bob, thank you. How can our listeners, if they want to get in touch with you for class or information or anything on these, what's the best way to get a hold of you?
I'll give you my email. It's all one word. It all runs together and it's all small letters. It's fire prevention officer, the number 11 at gmail.com. And they can call me on my cell if they want to, area code 318-564-2561. Either one of those methods will work pretty well in reaching me.
You know, Bob, I want to thank you again. The title of the article, it's in the July 2020 Fire Engineering, 10 Commandments for Operations in Small Box Stores with Limited Staffing. And while we're taping this, on October 7th of 2020, that on yesterday, the 6th, there was a very serious fire in the Northeast in Elizabeth, New Jersey, in a furniture, two-story furniture resale shop or furniture store that I encourage you to Google, take a look at. It was on Facebook. But this fire was well involved in the middle of the day or late afternoon. It unfortunately claimed the lives of some young children that were inside the store with their mother. It really shows the amount of fire that can, that amount of materials and the amount of fire and the spread that can, that you can have in these stores. And so just a harsh reminder of how difficult and the amount of fire that you can have in these buildings. So I encourage our listeners that after you listen to this, to Google Elizabeth, New Jersey fire that occurred again on October 6th. So Bob, thank you very much. I appreciate you having taken the time to be on the podcast, and be safe.